Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, actor L. Peter Callender and director John Tracy talk about the Aurora Theater's West Coast premiere of Breakfast with Mugabe. Michel Laprise, the director and creator of the new Cirque du Soleil show opening this week, Curios, shares his vision. Playwright Jonathan Spector talks about his play In From the Cold, being staged at the Live Oak Theater. And conductor Michael Morgan will share details about the upcoming concert of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, for which he is guest conductor. Stay with us. The Aurora Theater Company continues its 23rd season with the West Coast premiere of Fraser Grace's provocative recent off-Broadway hit Breakfast with Mugabe, playing through the 7th of December, directed by John Tracy and starring L. Peter Callender and Dan Hyatt. Two members of the creative team join me in studio to talk about the play, director John Tracy and actor Peter Callender. John works as a director, playwright, designer, and educator who has worked with such local companies as Shotgun Players, the SF Playhouse. He directed the recent terrific productions of Man of La Mancha, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, also at the Magic Theater, Marin Theater Company, and ACT, among many others, as well as at the Aurora, where he most recently directed Gideon's Knot. He's worked elsewhere around the country as well, and is the recipient of the Kennedy Center Meritorious Achievement Award, among other accolades, including 15 North Bay Arty Awards, a Sacramento Ellie, and a Bay Area Critics Circle Award. John, welcome back, and I've really enjoyed your work in the past, so this should really be quite a treat.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Of course. Yeah. It's also a pleasure to welcome back to our airwaves L. Peter Callender, veteran Bay Area actor who has appeared in over 35 plays as associate artist at Cal Shakes and is artistic director at African American Shakespeare Company. Recent work saw Peter at Cal Shakes as Leontes in The Winter's Tale, as well as at Marin Theater Company, San Jose Stage as Henry in Race. Other Bay Area credits include Berkeley Rept, ACT, Magic Theater, Shakespeare, Santa Cruz, and many companies around the country. A pleasure, Peter, to have you back as well.
Always nice to be back here. Thank you so much.
Wow. Robert Mugabe, an interesting subject for a play. John, how does playwright Fraser Grace make Mugabe a sympathetic character? This is a dictator that has been compared to both Nelson Mandela and Idi Amin. I would think the direction would go towards springtime for Hitler rather than a psychological drama.
Sure. Well, there's so many different ways in. One of the things that he hasn't shied away from anything that Robert Mugabe may be. I think he poses a question for all of us, and that's why plays like this are so important. What is our relationship to our own relevance? And what I mean by that is that we are concerned, each one of us, with who we think we are, and that relationship with what the world thinks we are, and then time shifts those things into this gray persona in which we don't really know what we are in actuality. You have someone like Robert Mugabe, who started as a freedom fighter and was thought of as a freedom fighter. And then when we look at ourselves now, 2014, one of the things that's amazing about this play is we are talking about people who are still making history as we speak on these airwaves. Yeah? And he may still find himself the freedom fighter on one level, but he's still also aware that he's known throughout the world as a despot and a dictator. Somewhere between all these things is a highly conflicted individual, and that's what Fraser Grace gives us, is a highly conflicted individual trying to find himself and his own persona and perhaps hiding and ducking behind things that feel strong while scratching the surface of things that he's even fearing about himself.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you've played some rather larger-than-life characters, Richard III, Leontes. Is Mugabe equally Shakespearean in your eyes?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you. Yes, he is. If you combine Richard and the Scotsman, I hope your audience knows what I mean. I'll say it, Macbeth. Ooh.
I was screwed.
If you combine those two characters and then sprinkle in a couple of other Shakespearean characters, you have this play and you have this man. He is complicated. He's brilliant. He is despotic, as John just said. He loves his family. He is smart, educated, shiesty, funny, charming, all that stuff. And you put all those together, and you can come up with Richard. You can come up with the Scottish player. You can come up with a number of other Shakespearean characters. And that was one of the first draws for me as an actor when I read this play.
Mm. And if I can chime in on that, another thing that's so very Shakespearean about this character is that you can see all of those things, and you can also see yourself. And that's what makes this so relevant, too, is that even in this larger-than-life character with so much of himself that we find scary or, dare I even say, demonic, we can also, within that, the scariest part about him is that we see shades of ourselves.
Mm. I mentioned that at the outset that this is a psychological thriller, so to speak. Yeah. And Dan Hyatt, who was wonderful in recent productions of Wittenberg, The Arsonists, as well as in 1776, Major Barbara, plays the white psychiatrist, someone who has an interesting past himself and a quite questionable future. Perhaps tell us what's going on this psychiatrist's couch in the premise of the play, if you could.
Great. So Dan is playing a character named Dr. Perrick, who is, as you said, a white psychiatrist in Zimbabwe. He's a third-generation Zimbabwean. And he's also a white farmer. And I keep putting white in front of that because that needs to be denoted within the story. At this point in Zimbabwe, the white population is 1%. And, starting in the late 60s into the 80s, when a second Chimurenga pushed a lot of the white colonialists out, Dr. Perrick is a remnant of that, and is he's here because he's been brought to the state house in order to deal with Robert Mugabe's psychological problems.
At the invitation of Mugabe.
He's not quite sure what it is yet. It has not been given to him until he gets to the room, and it is brought to him that Robert Mugabe suffers from an Ngozi, which is a spiritual idea of Peter. I don't know if you wanted to slide into this right here.
Ngozi is a spirit that takes over someone's body. The true meaning of the word, it takes over someone's body. It becomes an entity. And that is the true meaning of the word. In this particular case, Ngozi, spelled N-G-O-Z-I, is a ghost, a haunt, or, and they say in the South, a hant, that is terrifying Robert Mugabe. The year is 2001. Robert Mugabe is 77. Elections are right around the corner. He is experiencing this entity that haunts him, that troubles him. He sees this person. The person is Josiah Tongogara. Josiah Tongogara was a comrade, a freedom fighter, the general of the other forces of liberation. And who knows what happened in history? We let the audience decipher that through the play. But Tongogara has been haunting him, and he asks Dr. Perrick to help him through that.
Well, it's interesting that it's dwelling on this one person, because history is telling us between 10,000 and 80,000 Zimbabweans were eliminated, either directly at Mugabe's order or through his regime. Mm-hmm.
And to that end, to put another word in there, this Ngozi is haunting, but it's crippling Robert Mugabe, and it makes Dr. Perrick look at something larger than that, that maybe it is larger than Tongogara, or maybe it is much more personal than Tongogara. All revelations for the play, of course.
Interesting that Mugabe chose a white psychiatrist to come and help mm-hmm. him with this.
And this is that. That's part that of the, part of it is true. Dr. Peric, of course, is sort of an amalgamation of different ideas, but and not an not a and, but is all ultimately a fictional character, mm-hmm. Especially the fact that he is a farmer as well. But what it does do is when you have these scenes between Robert Mugabe and Dr. Peric, or shall I say, L. Peter Callender and Dan Hyatt, you also get these you get to put such a large, massive idea of the history of Zimbabwe and how it affects us all today under the microscope. And each one of these people they're larger than life because they symbolize so much, and they're it's one person fighting for it, an entire idea against mm-hmm. another person's ideas. Beautiful.
So yeah. The engagement of the white psychiatrist is the part of the historical headline that mm-hmm. Grace uses to create the rest of the headlines that are somehow incorporated into the play.
Absolutely.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Now, we're pre-taping this segment due to some scheduling issues while KLW is broadcasting the BBC. I understand Mugabe has an interesting relationship with the BBC.
Mugabe is not a best friends with the BBC at all. He calls it in the play the Blair Broadcasting Corporation because Blair reneged on promises made at the negotiation table during the independence conversations about independence, all the negotiations. And when time came for those promises to be met, such as Britain paying for some of the farms that were promised back to Zimbabwe, Britain would to pay the farmers, not Zimbabwe, Blair reneged on that. And many other promises and some sanctions and so on. So, no, although he was a dear friend of Britain, No more. He says Britain has gone to the dogs. So he's not a big fan of the BBC.
It's Peter Callender starring as Robert Mugabe in Breakfast with Mugabe. John Tracy, director, tell us who else is working with you in the cast.
Thanks. Great. Yeah. I mean, of course, we have L. Peter Callender. We have Dan Hyatt. We have Leontine Mbele Mbong and Adrian Roberts. And let me, if I can, just take the moment. Like, it's just so exciting when you look at, you know, working day in and day out like we do in this theater, trying to bring stories forward. And so there's good days and there's bad days and there's feast and there's top ramen days. But then there are these moments when you just look at in tomorrow we open this play. And personally, the idea that I have the chance to work and learn from those four artists and watch them learn from one another and to know that bringing them together means that they all walk out as better artists because they have spent this particular time together telling this particular story is amazing. And I really hope that audiences get down to witness just a piece of that.
It's a fascinating story.
Totally agree. Dan Hyatt and I have been friends for years. We've done a bunch of shows at Cal Shakes, and this is the first time we've actually had major conversation on stage. I've always wanted to work with Adrian Roberts. Adrian Roberts, as a matter of fact, is also a fellow Trinidadian. I was born in Trinidad, so was he. And the award-winning actress, she just won the TBA Best Actress Award, Leontine Mbele Mbong. She's in the show. She plays my wife. It's just a pleasure to go to work every day.
Absolutely.
Super cast, super director, fantastic evening of some very provocative theater at the Aurora. It's Breakfast with Mugabe, information at auroratheater.org, playing through December 7th. Peter, John, thanks for taking some time today.
Absolute pleasure, as always. Thank you.
Really look forward to it.
Thank you.
Still to come this hour, a conversation with playwright Jonathan Spector and director Christine Young, as well as one of the other actors in Just Theater's production of In From the Cold. Plus a talk with Michael Morgan about his guest conducting stint with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. And next, well, the U.S. premiere of the latest Cirque du Soleil extravaganza is about to get underway just south of AT&T Park. The $28 million production of Curios, A Cabinet of Curiosities, will be running until mid-January, underway starting tomorrow. An evening at Cirque is sure to entertain, and I had the great pleasure of talking with the creator of the work, Michel Laprise, recently downtown.
Tell us first how a Cirque production gets to be from conception to actual birth.
Well, it's a lot of work. And we're very good at producing really sophisticated shows. So we started by saying, okay, let's do something low-tech, okay? Because we have the physical and financial means to do a lot of, like, moving parts, da da da. I said, okay, but let's go in the other direction. Let's go back to human. Let's go to back to when we were in the streets, you know, and we didn't have the technology, but we were good. So let's do that, and let's take that risk, and let's see where it leads us. So there's no turntables on the stage. There is not even traps on the stage, but what we do on it is fresh and new, you know. So it was a good, disruptive, provocative way to work, and we have a great process. So it was nice for me to come as the fresh guy and say, okay, why do we do it like that? Oh, because we usually do it? Not a good reason enough. Let's try something else.
Give us a sense of a time frame from the idea of Curios, the Cabinet of Curiosities, to putting it on.
It's a little bit more than 2 years, which is not too long. It's not too short. But it's 2 years. They used to tell me, well, Michel, because at the beginning I started, you know, with my experience at Evans department, I started like a sprint. And they said, Michel, it's a marathon, so pace yourself. I said, mm-hmm. But did I continue going fast. And everybody was going fast. So it's not complacent in terms of process. And we were working like at a super big pace all the time because, you know, I staged the show basically in a month, first month. So then we had time to change the things, move things around, and God, did we do it, you know. But it was great. It was a lot of fun.
So give us a synopsis of the Curios, Cabinet of Curiosities.
A synopsis.
Yes, good.
Well, it's the story of a man. We call him the Seeker. He's traveled the world, and he collected objects of curiosities, things that fascinate him, things that when he looks at them, he has alpha waves going really high level. And he doesn't understand them completely. There's a part of mystery on those objects. And he's built a machine, okay? This machine, he hopes, will allow him to access the invisible dimension because he is convinced that in that dimension, there is a place called the Valley of the Possible Impossibles. And in that place rest all the dreams before they are dreamt on the planet Earth. This is also where the crazy ideas that we abandon on Earth go, you know, when you abandon them. So he wants to access this valley and bring back on Earth the poetry and the crazy ideas. To answer your question, this is the story of this seeker. Okay, he's built a machine to access the invisible world, and it starts at the beginning of the show, but something goes wrong. And instead of having him traveling to the other dimension, he has three people from Kyrgyzstan. It's the country we invented. So the three Kyrgyzstanians come in his world, and they will change it. They will mess around, influx freedom and craziness into his world. And they will take his curiosities and the curious objects and bring them to life. So, for example, we have like the second act is a box that comes, and it's a self-contained world because a cabin of curiosity was also like a microcosmos, so a self-contained world. So they open that box, and you have the two acrobats and their apparatus and the safety mats and the lights, everything is contained into this box that just deploys itself, and they do the act, and then, whoop, the box closes and goes back to the cabinet. So there's a lot of props. There's a full truck of props, because I come from theater, and at one point in the production, the director of production, the very lovely Gabrielle Pinkstone, she said to me, Michel, we are just like at the third of the rehearsals, and you have more props than we ever seen in any touring show. I said, well, thank you. To me, it's important. And we have to rearrange the trucks and stuff. So it's a full truck of objects, you know.
Well, one of the hallmarks of a Cirque production is spectacle, of course, and I think an over-the-top experience for the audience. Now, I believe this is a $28 million production or something in that neighborhood.
Are there any limitations for you as a director?
Oh, my God. It's awful to say yes, but it is. I mean, I think we have more value than 28 million, seriously, because we had so much on the table at the day one, and I was never wanted to renounce on anything. So the team had to find ways. I mean, we did prototypes to make sure that we would not waste any money. We're doing prototype a lot, but in plywood, and we kept reusing the same plywood sheets. You know, that we just recycle them, and they would show me some volumes. Okay, let's go ahead. So we were sure not to waste the money, and we're pretty ecological more and more at SICK, so we didn't want to waste the people's time nor the matter, and so. You know, to tell you the truth, pretty much everything that was on the drawings at the beginning end up in the stage. There's
very little you had to say no to from your designers to on up.
Well, I'm stubborn also, and they were really wanting to do a beautiful show. So sometimes there was a no, but I said, oh, come on, let's do it still. Let's find a way. And, I mean, I have the easy part. It's the designers were like able to find the solutions and stuff, but yeah, there's a lot.
Well, talk to us a little bit about the music that's involved in Curios.
Well, music at SICK is one of the core things. It's live and it has to feel live. And at the beginning, we said, we did the director of creation, Chantal Tremblay, we agreed super much on that. We said, in today's world, there's a lot of sequences and computer music and stuff, and it's great. I mean, I love to go raving and listen to that type of music, but for SICK, you know, I used to cast the most amazing musicians, and sometimes, whoops, I don't hear the guitar because it's too many layers, and it's okay. But in this show, we said, no, I really want to make sure that we hear the violin player, because we have, honestly, the best band ever. When you do a casting of your musicians, you have your first choice, second and third. We have all our first choices. They were all available. The contract negotiation went well. And so it's a phenomenal band. And so much emotion. The accordion player, Lydia, every single note has her heart in it, you know. And, I mean, I can say that for every musician. So the music is electro swing. And it's the owner of SICK who guided us into that. He said, go with electro string, guys. And so it's very warm. There's a lot of acoustic instruments, too. You will very hear them and you feel them. And we're going back to a very warm music. And it was a lot of work because, you know, we wanted to do our own version of electro swing. And Guy said at the beginning, Guy, La Liberté, the founder of SICK, he said, I don't want you guys to go into the world beat music because we've done that. All right? So, wow, okay. So how do you make the people travel, but not with Indian music or whatever? So we went into a lot of, like, we have gramophone sounds. So, again, I wanted to do a show very warm, very low-tech. So the equivalent, and the show is sepia. The palette of color is sepia, so it's super warm. And sepia is great because it leads you to an era, but you don't know exactly. Like black and white, you know it's the 20s, 40s, or early past millennium. But sepia, when is sepia? We don't know.
So it's kind of looking into the future, but it's also drawing on the 19th century mechanization period.
Actually, yeah. And our aesthetic is very steampunk, but steampunk is usually Victorian projected in a future. But our steampunk is more French world exhibition in Paris 1900. So, yes, it is. The show is set in the second half of the 19th century because everything was happening at that point. Invention of gramophones, the development of the railway system, the electricity was invented and developed. You had also the telegraph. So a lot of things were there to connect the people in between themselves. I wanted to speak about our era, but the best way to do it, like Shakespeare was doing, I'm saying that humbly, the best way to speak about your era is to use another era that's similar to it, so you have more freedom and stuff. So this was an era really bubbling, and everything was being invented, and all those inventions were connecting people. And there was an obsession for communication, too. So, and because I wanted to do a show very optimistic and very creative in every single aspect. And that's why I love steampunk, because steampunk is so interesting, because it's an amalgam, the union of different little objects. So every object has its own history. But when you put them together, when you assemble them, then it's another story that would never be possible. So it's the sum of the elements is bigger than the addition of those elements. So, and this is what a Cirque show is, because you have people coming from everywhere, and when they come together, they can do something more amazing.
Well, speaking of the mechanics of not only the very cabinet of curiosities that's the centerpiece of the show, the Cirque du Soleil organization has to also be a very well-oiled machine to be able to travel as extensively as it does.
Yes, the way people work is the riggers, the technicians, props people. It's a performance too. I mean, they're really high caliber performers in what they do, and it's so impressive. And everything is so well thought. It's so practical, and it's fun. I mean, you see, I've seen a lot of backstages in my life, but what's great at Curios is that you see the props people with a smile in the darkness. They don't, you know, it's just fun. It's so, yeah. And they have this tour is a super happy tour. People have a great time to do the show. So this is beyond any dream.
Well, speaking of that, is directing a show like this considered the pinnacle of roles for you at Cirque, or are there other projects that you've got currently in the hopper for down the road?
Well, it's funny because I started this week to work on one, possibly two other projects, but Curios is very special. It's and I said I wrote a long letter last week to the cast and crew. I said, you guys are a hard act to follow, because I mean, it's the best. It's really you always say, oh, it's a family set. But this is very true this time. I'm not saying it's not true the other times, but it is more true. And so I'm looking forward to the next adventures. And I know, I mean, life has beautiful things in store for me. And because I want to contribute. And it's not for me, it's me for them, you know. And but this is exceptional. It's so much fun.
Well, let's stay in touch then about your next production and beyond.
Okay.
And I wish you a wonderful production here in San Francisco.
We're really excited because, you know, the aesthetic of the show is steampunk. And also because of the creativity that is in the show. I am very influenced and inspired by the West Coast. And all the innovation that came and is coming from this section of the world. It's phenomenal. So to me, I'm so happy that the world, the U.S. premiere is here, and I'm inviting inventors to the premiere, people that I read books about, and because it's the best place to do it. So we're really looking forward.
Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Michel Lepreuze recorded in downtown San Francisco when he was in town preparing for Curios. You could take the journey to Curiostan by visiting Cirque du Soleil at the AT&T Park parking lot. The tents are up now through January 18th. We've got a link to the show at our website, kalw.org. Let's hear a little bit of the music originally composed for Curios by the composer and musical director, Raphael Beaux. Touch of Clouds, an original work by Raphael Bow, being done as part of the Cirque du Soleil performance. Still to come, a conversation with Maestro Michael Morgan about his guest stint with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. And next, well, Just Theater presents the world premiere of In From the Cold by Jonathan Spector at the Live Oak Theater on Shattuck Avenue in North Berkeley, now through November 23rd. It's a hilarious as well as troubling new work inspired by the little-known true story of the Cold War's biggest spy, someone who returns home after having prevented World War III and now has to be more concerned with alternate side parking and street sweeping. In From the Cold was a winner of Aurora Theater's Global Age Prize, featured in Playwrights Her Foundation's Rough Reading Series and a finalist for the O'Neill Playwrights Conference, was commissioned and developed in Just Theater's new play lab. It's directed by Christine Young and written by Jonathan Spector, who is also co-artistic director of Just Theater. They join me in studio along with one of the actors in the play, Seton Brown. Well, let's start right in with a live reading from the play from Seton Brown, who plays the character Alex, son of the spy that came in from the cold, recently moved back home and now a substitute teacher at his alma mater high school. Seton.
Okay, does anybody have any ideas? What do you think are, like, the values being expressed in Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Well, okay, think about it. What's he do on his day off? He skips school, drives a Ferrari, eats at a fancy restaurant, goes to an art museum, leads a parade, and then what happens to him in the end? Exactly. He gets away with it. I mean, these kids, they're already incredibly privileged. Look at those houses. And what's their aspiration? To be a grown-up rich person. It's basically reinforcing this. Okay, I think you have to understand. I'm sorry if this is kind of a tired metaphor, but I think it works. You know, if the 60s were like this wild party of idealism and altruism and social justice, then the 70s were like that same party, but it's like the party at like 5 in the morning, where the only people still up had either done a lot of chemical imbibing, or they were just wretchedly drunk and sort of half passed out, or they were just really, really not ready to give up on the idea of finding someone to go home with. So after that, when the 80s rolled around, it was like the morning after the party. It was like noon, and the people who had gone to bed at 6 a.m. woke up with these wretched hangovers, and their attitude was basically, I am never partying again because I feel really horrible and I don't want to keep doing this to myself. And they totally ignore the fact that from like 9:30 to 1 or so, it was a really fantastic party. Everyone was having a great time. The problem wasn't having a party in the first place. The problem was not going to bed when it was time to go to bed. But instead, they're like, no way, I'm AA all the way. Everything about my previous lifestyle was wrong, and the only way forward is to do the exact opposite of everything I did before. All that stuff about peace and community and spirituality, forget it. I want to be rich. And this is basically what the whole movie is all about. It's saying that you can be a rich, privileged white kid and be a rebel. And that, in fact, in this era, that's the only way to truly be cool. Have your cake and eat it, too. Stick it to the man and drive the Ferrari. And, you know, we're still... The effects of this today are... I mean, I don't know if you guys listen to NPR, but there was a lot, you know, during the financial crisis, there were a bunch of interviews with these Wall Street guys, and they were saying how they were all inspired by Gordon Gekko from Wall Street and the whole greed is good thing. Wall Street? No? We're watching that for sure next week. Okay, but the point is just, I think that the cultural genesis for the moral vacuum at the center of this mortgage-backed security thing can really more accurately be traced back to Ferris Bueller.
Very nice. Seton Brown, who plays Alex in From the Cold at Just Theater. He's an MFA grad from ACT here in San Francisco. Thank you, Seton. I'd like to introduce the playwright Jonathan Spector, who is also co-artistic director of Just Theater. His own plays have been produced and developed with Aurora Theater, Playwrights Foundation, Playground, and Source Theater Festival, among many others. A recent SF State grad student, he also spent several years in the theater world of New York City. Jonathan, welcome to KLW in Open Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the show is directed by Christine Young, a Princeton and University of Iowa grad. In addition to directing, she's an associate professor in the Performing Arts and Social Justice Program at the University of San Francisco. She's taught and directed in a number of Bay Area groups, including Tenderloin Opera Company, California Shakespeare Theater, Magic Theater, the New Conservatory Theater, San Francisco Shakespeare, and Golden Thread Productions, among others. She also created and curates the Works by Women San Francisco blog, which spotlights theatrical work written, directed, designed, and produced by women artists in the San Francisco Bay Area. Welcome to Open Air to you, Christine.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So let's back up to a little bit about the show itself, Jonathan. I understand the play draws upon some personal experiences from your adolescence. Could you enlighten us on that?
Well, the jumping off point for the play is some years ago I discovered that a person who was one of the biggest spies through the Cold War had been living for many years in secret in a townhouse across the street from my suburban high school. And I, without being too mysterious, I'm not fully at liberty to say how I discovered that, but I became sort of fascinated by that and did a lot of research about this person's life, and that the combination of that, that sort of high stakes and the banality was fascinating to me, and the sacrifices this person made throughout their life. And so that was sort of the how the play began.
Interesting way to get to know your neighbors. Christine, you have a background in working with new plays. How is it working with the author in the room, so to speak?
It's fantastic. I'm actually a director who prefers to work on new plays for exactly that reason, because there's something so rich about the opportunity to collaborate directly with the person from whose imagination the theatrical world originated. I've actually known Jonathan for a pretty long time. We used to work together at the Playwrights Foundation. He was a director when I knew him. Now he's a playwright. And the opportunity to talk together with the playwright about their vision and to understand from them, as well as from what's on the page, the sort of fullest possible realization of the theatrical world is what can happen when you have that person in the room with you.
Interesting. Now, we talked about this being based on your own discovery of your neighborhood. Let's talk a little bit about the characters involved. We have the Alex character that we heard in his monologue. He comes home to teach at his alma mater high school history. Is that correct? But he's learning that the kids are not so enlightened as to history.
Yes, that's right. He is a somewhat ill-prepared teacher and finds himself attempting to connect with these kids through showing old movies and trying to get them to understand a sense of their history and culture through that.
And I love that old movies are considered Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
movies that for him seem very present, but that they have never heard of.
Right.
Movies from his youth.
Experience in your own way? How did the Alex character come to shape?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think I was interested in this sort of contrast of the generations between the generation that his father, who had the spy, who'd had a great deal of purpose and certainty in the world in response to the Cold War, and then the sort of post 9/11 generation that follows, would seem to be both personally more adrift in the world, as maybe America's place is also a little more adrift in its role. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about the other characters that are involved in the play, then.
So there's his father, Howard, the former spy, a Russian spy, and a couple of his former CIA associates, and then there are some former friends of Alex's who he reconnects with when he's gets back in town, and everything kind of gets thrown together as hijinks ensue.
Christine, tell us about the cast you've assembled. You witnessed some genius here.
We have a fantastic cast, which includes Julian Lopez-Maria playing Howard. Sarah Moser plays a character called Carrie, who's sort of a love interest for Alex. We have Harold Pierce playing the kind of goofy sidekick friend. And David Snyko rounding out the cast, playing the CIA agents.
Oh, that's great. David Snyko has just been doing some wonderful things here in the Bay Area. I'm thinking of The Chairs he was in, Crispy Critters in The Scarlet Night, and a fantastic job in Ubu Roy.
Yes, so it's really a powerhouse cast.
That's fantastic. What are we going to see when we come to the theater?
You're going to walk in and you're going to discover a set that resembles a basement rec room from your childhood, especially if you grew up on the East Coast, and complete with wood paneling and a Lazy Boy recliner. It's a sort of decrepit family space. It's a relic of history. It's a space that so much happened in for so many of us when we were young. And in that space, over the course of 90 minutes, you're going to learn about the characters. You're going to laugh a lot. You're going to be inspired to think about some bigger ideas beyond just this one family, ideas that reach out into history and into our current place in the political landscape. And you're also going to have some exciting ride because the play actually unfolds in some unexpected ways.
Nice. I'm looking forward to it. Having not been to the Just Theater space, tell us about the space in Berkeley you're using.
So we're at the Live Oak Theater in Berkeley, which is an historic theater in an historic spot. It's in the Live Oak Park Community Center. A lot of folks don't know there's a theater there. It's been in constant operation since the 1950s. There's been a space for leisure and entertainment on that spot since the 1910s. It's around the corner from Dorothea Lange's old house. It's down the road from Julia Morgan's old house. So it's just a really ripe spot for creativity. And it's a beautiful space. Small proscenium theater. I think you'll really enjoy your time there.
Nice. Now through November 23rd, it's In From the Cold. Jonathan Spector, thanks for coming in and taking a little time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Christine Young, have a wonderful run.
Thank you.
And thanks again, Seton, for that nice reading.
Thanks a lot.
More information about In From the Cold is at the website justtheater.org. That's Just Theater with an E-R this time around, justtheater.org. The charming beginning of the second movement of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 2, The Little Russian, originally intended as a bridal march to the composer's unpublished opera, Undine. The symphony is otherwise full of authentic Russian and Ukrainian folk melodies, a couple of which we'll sample shortly. The full work, along with music of Mahler and Konrad Susa, will be performed next Saturday, the 22nd, by the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. Well, this is a banner year for local orchestras and conductors. We've been celebrating 20 years of Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. Mitchell Klein is in his 30th year with the Peninsula Symphony, as is my guest next week, Eric Kujawski with the Redwood Symphony. And the Oakland East Bay Symphony is celebrating 25 years with my next guest, Michael Morgan. Maestro Morgan has been conducting since the age of 12 and has worked with this era's most acclaimed names in classical music, including Leonard Bernstein, Gunther Schuller, and Seiji Ozawa, among many others. He serves as artistic director of the Oakland Youth Orchestra, music director of the Sacramento Philharmonic Orchestra and the Sacramento Opera, and was artistic director of Festival Opera in Walnut Creek, California, for more than 10 seasons. In addition to leading the Oakland East Bay Symphony now for 25 years, he crosses the Bay frequently, teaching conducting at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and lingering on Wednesday evenings for the past several weeks to act as guest conductor for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, which has its next concert next Saturday at Calvary Presbyterian Church, performing music of the late, great Konrad Susa, Gustav Mahler, and Tchaikovsky. Maestro Morgan, always a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves.
Always nice to be here.
Nice. And a very special pleasure now, having fully worked with you on this bar set for our listening audience. Full disclosure here, I'm playing flute, alto flute, and piccolo with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. And it's so great to see the way you work with an ensemble. It's a really, we're all very, very privileged and honored to have you as a guest conductor for the set.
Yeah, I've been doing it so long. If you put the rat in the maze enough times, he learns the way.
Well, in addition to prepping for this bars concert, just last week you had the opening of the Oakland East Bay Symphony season with a new work by Chris Brubeck. How did that go?
That was fantastic. Chris Brubeck and four French musicians did this sprawling 40-50-minute work for jazz quintet and orchestra that was a commemoration of the D-Day invasion, because Chris Brubeck and Guillaume St. James, the saxophonist who co-wrote the piece, their fathers had both been involved in D-Day, and so they wrote a piece together. together. It was wonderful. That was just a wonderful experience all around. And the first half of that concert was actually Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. So we are just knee-deep in Tchaikovsky these days.
You are indeed. And those melodies are hard to get out of your head, aren't they? That's amazing. Now, on to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, an ambitious program, a work by your recently late San Francisco Conservatory colleague, Conrad Sousa, called The Blue Hour. Tell us a little bit about Conrad, if you would.
Well, Conrad was actually more known as an opera composer. I don't know if there are any other orchestra works by Conrad. I heard this one, which is extremely evocative, the Blue Hour being the hour just before the sun sets, and it was written on the beach in San Diego, and it's very evocative of hearing a lot of different sounds of the city and of the beach and of people playing music sort of overlapping, a lot of layering going on in that piece. And I heard it at the conservatory a few years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. I've done it with both of my professional orchestras, and when this chance came to do a concert with Rainbow, I thought perfect way to remember Conrad.
It's a fun piece, too. It's a lot of fun to play.
It's a great, it really is. It's just a beautiful piece of music. Mm.
Zachary Gordon is our baritone soloist for Mahler's Kinder Toten Lieder, or as I like to call them, the Dead Kid Songs.
Yes. You know, it's hard to get people to, it's hard to, I love, they are one of my favorite song cycles. It's actually hard to get people to sing them because people feel superstitious about them if they actually have children. So you have to actually find people who are either willing to sing them or who, like Zachary, have no children. So they're okay with it.
Well, interesting that you should bring that up because Mahler selected five of this Friedrich Ruckert's poems. The texts are pulled from a group of 428 poems by
yes.
Ruckert, who lived from 1833 to 30, or written in 1833-34, in reaction to the illness and death from scarlet fever of two of his children. Poems, by the way, which were not intended for publication. And Mahler selected just five of these poems, set as the leader, which he composed between 1901 and 1904. The songs and texts, mixture of feelings going on. But the poignancy, I think, is really emphasized that he wrote them then, because 4 years after he wrote those songs, Mahler's own daughter, Maria, age four, died of scarlet fever.
Yes, and hence the sort of jinx that the songs carry, and so people are very careful about singing them.
And Mahler himself wrote that had his child died earlier, he could not have possibly written these songs.
No, it would have been too much. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Much. Yes.
The songs are written for either a mezzo-soprano or baritone. Have you performed them both ways? Do you have a preference?
I don't think I have ever performed them with the mezzo because the texts are so male. They are all from the father's point of view. And so I've always done it with baritone. I have nothing whatever against mezzos. They are wonderful people. But I've just always done these songs with male singers.
Hmm. Well, the texts are so very poignant. Let's hear a little bit of Wenn dein Mutterlein. Can you introduce that song for us?
Basically, it's about seeing the mother come through the door. And instead of looking at the mother's face, you look at the point on the mother where the child's head would be, you know, about waist level. That's where his eyes would fall whenever she would come in because she's expecting to see the child, who, of course, is no longer there, which makes it, which is why the song is, in fact, so poignant, as this notion that you look at the level where the child is supposed to be as opposed to the mother who's actually entering the house.
Let's hear some music of Mahler sung by Hermann Pry and then more with conductor Michael Morgan. so beautifully orchestrated and so carefully done, that beautiful English horn.
And very simply, very few instruments playing at any given time except in the very last movement. Other than that, the orchestra is used extremely sparingly.
And again, the texts aren't all maudlin and anguish. There's a note of hope at the end.
Yes, absolutely, and a lovely what amounts to a lullaby in the end.
Hmm. That was Hermann Pry with the Royal Concertgebouw and that brief expert. You can hear Zachary Gordon, our baritone soloist, next Saturday. Well, we should move on to Tchaikovsky, and we have to talk a little bit about politics here. It's subtitled The Little Russian in the news right now. It's not about some short comrade in Moscow, is it?
No, it's called Little Russian because Ukraine was called Little Russia. I personally just call it Ukrainian now because I think the name Little Russian is Little Russia for Ukraine fell out of favor some time ago and, of course, would be way out of favor now. So I just prefer to think of it as Ukrainian and not Little Russian.
Well, you know, in addition to the whole Ukraine issue, there's the issue of Tchaikovsky. I mean, are they going to start pulling down statues of Tchaikovsky now in Russia because he's one of their most celebrated gay composers? Are they tearing down statues related to Apple and...
Well, you know, once again, denial, not just a river. They can just ignore. They can just ignore, pretend that he wasn't. It was just a large historical oops and not actually deal with that. But being Ukraine and it being a gay composer and all those things together made it actually a fairly obvious choice for a concert with the Rainbow Symphony at this time.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we take it on tour to St. Petersburg in Russia?
Yes, let's do that.
See how that goes over.
Let's not fly, though.
Well, we mentioned that the tunes, other than that slow wedding march, which is such a charming little movement, that second movement, a lot of folk tunes are involved in this, and Ukrainian tunes, starting right off with a horn solo, playing a Ukrainian variation, Down the Mother Volga. Let's hear just a little bit of that, and then we can talk a little bit about the songworm that is the fourth movement. Beautiful song, Down the Mother Volga, experiencing some variations and then with various forces of the full orchestra assembled.
Yes, it's actually quite lovely. The Oakland Youth Orchestra played this piece a couple years ago, and I didn't conduct it, but I just remember one of the kids going on, you know, high school kid going on about how beautiful he thought this tune was. I love those moments with those moments of discovery with very young musicians.
And then our various other movements, we've got, he uses that solo tune from the Mother Volga is also used by Rimsky-Korsakov and Russian Easter Overture.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
As well. The second movement, beautiful, really wild, fun scherzo that is just like could have been out of the Nutcracker. It's so much fun.
I've noticed doing these two Tchaikovsky symphonies back-to-back, five last week and two this week, that he's definitely the composer of the Nutcracker. You know, I try not to let that remind me of that too much.
Well,
that annual ritual.
Well, let me just put it this way: as a flutist, it's there are parts of the symphony that are a real nutcracker.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a couple of experiments, particularly in the flutes, that don't quite pan out in the Second Symphony.
Interesting writing, said at least.
Yes.
And then the final movement uses a folk song called The Crane, that it gets subject to a workout in so many ways. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, you can't really call it variation when you just do it over and over again, really.
But it stays with you, that's for sure.
It has to.
We're gonna go out with that music. Michael, I thank you for spending a little time with us today. And I look forward to your next concert, which is called Breaking Bread Together.
Let Us Break Bread Together.
A holiday tribute to Pete Seeger. That's with the Oakland East Bay Symphony on December 14th. Thanks for coming in, Michael.
Thank you.
Music of Tchaikovsky to take us out, and a couple other announcements inviting you to join me on Monday evening for Explorations in Music at 9 p.m. Our last two episodes of Explorations with Alexander String Quartet and Robert Greenberg will feature pianist Sarah Cahill in a couple of last works. Also, Sarah, this Sunday, is off to MIT for a concert, so she'll be subbing for her will be Parker Monroe for Revolutions Per Minute, Sunday evening from 8 to 10. In addition to the great theater mentioned on the cultural calendar, one of Joshua Kosman's classical picks for November is this Friday and Saturday at Zellerbach Hall, as Cal Performances presents Benjamin Britten's Curlew River. Check calperformances.org for more information. I'm David LaTulipe, your host for Open Air. A pleasure to bring you some cultural happenings here in the Bay Area. My thanks, as always, to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. You can send me segment ideas, david@kalw.org. At that website, kalw.org, all of our shows are archived, so you can have a listen once again or search for some of our recent guests. Music of Tchaikovsky, the Little Russian finale, finishing things out. Finale from the Little Russian Symphony No. 2 of Tchaikovsky, the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, performing that Saturday the 22nd. Information at their website, bars-sf.org. KLW is a media sponsor for An Evening with Neil deGrasse Tyson on February 11th, 2015. Join Dr. Tyson, award-winning astrophysicist, author, and host of the TV show Cosmos, for an evening of engaging conversation on science, exploration, and the world as we know it at the Orpheum Theater in San Francisco, February 11th. For more information, go to our website, kalw.org, where our programming is made possible by KLW listeners, folks like Monica Aiken of Frederiksberg, Denmark. Also, Michael and Susan Gainan live a little closer by Palo Alto. Thank you for becoming member listener supporters somewhere around the world here at kalw.org, where you can do the same at our website, kalw.org. An hour of news from the BBC is next. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time. And the time is 2 o'clock.